This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Today we hear from a Republican congressman who voted against cutting the EPA budget by 25%.
It would have been awful. Had this amendment passed, it would have been just awful. A terrible impact for all of us.
We hear a Democrat running for governor explain why he's on a listening tour of the state.
We need to understand what's not working in government right now and how is it that we are able to propose solutions that really dignify the values that we hold of equity and sustainability and justice.
Why and how Big Brother is watching more of us than ever.
So much cheaper that it's plausible to do it a huge amount more in connection to a lot more people.
And we'll introduce you to our latest artisan of Michigan.
You know, I try to make them look like a vintage robot from the future.
Yeah, I like that, vintage from the future.
Yes, vintage from the future.
But first, here's a news update. Hi there, welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Later this hour, we'll have some commentary on the Michigan legislature's move to allow candidates to raise unlimited amounts of dark money for friendly super PACs. But first, Congressman Fred Upton posted on Facebook this week explaining why he voted against an amendment that would have cut the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency by about 25%, which would have been more or less the cut that President Trump's budget proposed. Congressman Upton joins us now. So why did you vote against this EPA cut?
Well, look, we all care about having a safe environment, and we know that there are a number of items within the president's budget that certainly most of us in the Midwest disagreed with, one of which was, in essence, zeroing out the Great Lakes Restoration Fund. We've worked hard as a delegation, bipartisan. We get $300 million for this over the last couple of years, and it does a number of things from water quality to fighting not only the old invasive species like the lamprey eel, but also what we hope we can prevent the Asian carp from coming into the Great Lakes. Had this amendment passed, chances are pretty good that the effort that we did for the $300 million would be gone.
Yeah, I think that when people hear the EPA is getting cut, they don't think about things like this. I mean, a lot of this money goes to groups like Ducks Unlimited to restore wetlands, universities in Michigan to do research needed to help assess the health of the Great Lakes and fight invasive species, try to solve pollution problems like the algal blooms in Lake Erie, which can make Toledo's drinking water toxic. Do you think voters understand the EPA's role in those efforts?
You know, I don't know if most voters understand that or not, but if you had had a 25% cut in their budget, in essence taking it down to where the Trump administration budget request was, this program would be gone, those programs would be gone, and unless somehow restored magically, we would have been up the creek, as they say. It was important that we sent the message, and it's important that the Senate stay with us to make sure that we don't see this big cut.
I read an opinion piece from South Carolina Representative Ralph Norman in the Daily Signal, which the conservative think tank Heritage Foundation puts out. He made the case to cut the EPA budget in order to trim the agency back to focus on its core mission. Why do so many Republicans in the House feel the EPA should have a substantial budget cut?
Well, you know, as I swing across Michigan, certainly in my district here in Southwest Michigan, the Great Lakes are very important, and efforts to eliminate these programs, which is water quality, which is fighting the Asian carp. I mean, even a third grader knows what the Asian carp would do to decimate our fishing and sporting industry. But even things that are long-term, like the lamprey eel, and somehow that got in here, we've got to protect our air and water, and the Great Lakes is mighty important. And thank goodness we defeated this amendment, which would have been catastrophic had it been allowed to pass.
As I mentioned, I was looking at your Facebook post explaining your vote, and then I started reading the comments underneath. About half were thankful for the Great Lakes protections. Others were furious at you because they see the Environmental Protection Agency as out of control, a business killer, the worst kind of government overreach. What do you say to constituents when they make that argument to you?
Well, you know, we've had a number of face-to-face meetings, and, you know, there's always folks that are for and against any particular amendment, but I'd rather be on the side that I did, which protects the Great Lakes, than not, and worry about what the consequences would have been. No matter what you do on Facebook, you know, there's, you know, hardcore folks pro and con, but it would have been awful. Had this amendment passed, it would have been just awful. and a terrible impact for all of us. But I can't imagine people wanting to eliminate or reduce the funds by such a large margin. They just don't understand the ramifications of what would have happened.
And that's the point right there. I think a lot of times people see the EPA as a big, bad government tool, and they want to see it hurt. And they don't understand all of the ramifications of thinking
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, the Superfund cleanup. I mean, we've been engaged in a lot of different sites over here. We had big paper industry for a lot of years. And, you got polluted rivers and everything else. And we want them cleaned up. Don't want them to last there forever and being, contaminated. But this would have really been bad, the Great Lakes. I went out, Bill Huizinga's staff and myself went out last year. It was last summer on a U of M research boat. We recovered a torpedo that had crisscrossed Lake Michigan like 30, 35 times, measuring water quality and plankton and, all the different things that it can do. And all those would be done. It'd be done. Wouldn't have a dime for it had this amendment passed. As one that grew up on the Great Lakes, how this is important, it would have been terrible had this big cut been put into place. And we would have lost all the hard work that our delegation has done on a bipartisan basis to try and keep the Great Lakes, get it cleaner and maintain what we have today.
There was a piece in the New York Times recently that outlined a number of Republican members of Congress who are planning to retire. Your name was mentioned as someone who might be considering retirement. Then in the Washington Examiner, it was reported you're considering a run for the U.S. Senate. What's the real story?
Well, we're doing a lot of due diligence. We haven't made a decision. I've got a very aggressive schedule and have had the last good number of weeks and months. And we don't have any set timetable in terms of what we're going to do, but we're continuing to listen to people across the state, and we'll figure out something in the couple weeks ahead.
Well, everybody's announcing for a while now.
Well, it's a long time till November of next year. Of course, here in Michigan, the filing deadline's not until April, so I'm happy with the job that I'm doing. We had a good victory last year, 20 points, in fact, over my Democratic opponent, and time will tell. A lot of work to be done.
That's Congressman Fred Upton. He represents Michigan's 6th District. Thanks for talking with us.
You bet.
In the Detroit News today, Daniel Howes examines whether Detroit has the leadership to land the much-talked-about Amazon HQ2, a second headquarters for the massive online retailer. Daniel joins me now. Remind us, why are cities around the country scrambling to attract Amazon? What's at stake?
A $5 billion investment, up to 50,000 jobs, which is a number that is staggering in its proportion. That's like 10 auto plants, large auto plants. Obviously, they're not the same kind of jobs, and the average pay, the average compensation, they say, would be about $100,000 a year.
Average. Wow.
So you're looking at a potential economic boon, the likes of which few communities ever see, certainly dropped into their midst. I mean, over time, you see companies grow. Sometimes, certainly we've seen them in this part of the world. I mean, where you've seen companies that are over 100 years old that have grown to massive scale. But having somebody come in and say, hey, we want to invest in your community, we're going to invest this money, has all sorts of implications. The other thing is that Amazon gave people about 2 months, roughly a month and a half deadline. The deadline for responses is October 19th.
Yeah, that's a quick turnaround.
It's amazing.
You report that Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan is tapping Quicken Loans Chairman Dan Gilbert to put together a regional effort, mm-hmm. an application sort of. The Detroit Metro doesn't have a reputation for working well together. How difficult will this be?
I think it'll be less difficult than it would have been in the past. I've been writing for years now about the leadership in Southeast Michigan particularly, but even in the state, coming out of the global financial meltdown, the bankruptcies of General Motors and Ford, the later the bankruptcy of the city of Detroit, you see a lot of bipartisan city, suburb, business, labor, politics, cooperation that you wouldn't otherwise see in a lot of cases. I think people are going to be a lot more receptive to this. But the timeline is really, really tight. The mayor this week likened this whole thing to the effort back in 2004 and 2005, led by Roger Penske, to get the Super Bowl here in Detroit. And I covered that at the time and went to a couple Super Bowls in advance of that to see how communities put this stuff together. That was done over years now. We're now talking about something that would be done in a matter of weeks, at least to put together this proposal that they could advance to Amazon.
And the stakes are much, much higher. Yeah.
Exactly.
One of the Amazon requirements is regional transit. Voters recently turned down a proposal to make that happen. How much is that going to hurt Detroit's area's chances?
Well, I think a lot of people, critics or supporters, frankly, all agree that that could be a problem. That's the downside. The upside is that clearly there is time. This is not something that would happen in 2018. This is something that could happen over the next decade as this investment and Amazon's build out in whatever community it chooses happens. So I think there's some belief that, well, we can take another run at this, that the community writ large can say, let's try this again. We have an opportunity here. If we make these investments in rapid transit, we'll have a lot more people to use the system. It will pay for itself. The problem is trying to lasso that political will among the populace. Leaders can see that, but leaders can't ultimately deliver this unless they're going to write the checks. Well, like they did with the Q line in downtown Detroit, which is only 3.3 miles, which is clearly not what Amazon or any other company would have in mind.
So on your list of pros and cons, what does Detroit have going for it that will make it competitive when it's up against cities such as Atlanta, Denver, Chicago?
Well, in some senses, it's got a lot more options, I think. It's not as dense. It's got a business community and a political leadership that is, I think, very aggressive. And has really been tested through a lot of difficult times. I would put that in Detroit's corner. On the downside, I think transit is a problem. And I think another thing that is a problem we really don't know and we can't quantify is to what extent the stains of bankruptcy and collapse, which are not too far away, how indelible are those stains? And how much of people say, hey, we don't want any part of that. Flip side of that is there's a lot of upside. I mean, if you are Amazon, you come into a city like Detroit, you can score a lot of points politically around the country and with a lot of other people by investing in industrial America and helping to transform a piece of it.
Daniel Howes is business columnist at the Detroit News and a regular contributor here at Michigan Radio. Hey, thanks. Good talking to you.
Thanks, Lester.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. You are being tracked. Your actions are being tracked by government, retailers, credit agencies, social media, and it all goes much deeper than you might realize. Jonathan Weinberg is a professor of law at Wayne State University, and he recently wrote an article for The Conversation, which outlines surveillance of you now and where it might go in the future. He joins us now. You start out by writing, surveillance used to be expensive, but today it's much cheaper to keep tabs on people, even those who are not suspected of any kind of trouble. What's changed?
What's changed most importantly is digital technology. Back in the day, if government wanted to see where you were going, they would have to detail three shifts of people, 8 hours at a time, 24 hours a day, to stake out your house and actually follow you. And they could do that legally because everywhere you went was public, but it took a lot of resources. These days, government can set up license plate readers. If they have a warrant, they can just slap a transponder on your car. What's changed is that that's so much cheaper that it's plausible to do it a huge amount more in connection to a lot more people. And then the results just flow automatically into easily searchable and manipulable digital databases.
So they can use facial recognition, the license plates that you mentioned. You know, when I was reading it, I was thinking about the Green Light Initiative in Detroit, where they're using high-definition cameras at a lot of businesses all over the city. Well, if you wanted to keep tabs on somebody, that feed goes directly to the police department. It'd be pretty easy to do it with a whole system of that citywide.
No, that's absolutely right. And we're seeing that, say, in London. London, something that's been a boon to law enforcement is that the city is absolutely covered with closed-circuit TV cameras, both governmental and private. And, you know, that's great if you're trying to figure out who left the bomb. But it also means that nowhere you've gone is secret. It's all out there. Anyone with access to that information can track you. And again, what makes that possible is that it's pretty straightforward to take everybody's closed-circuit TV coverage and just combine it into a single searchable database.
You stress the data gathered about us can be used in making decisions about our credit, our employment, government benefits. And then you note that the data might be misinterpreted, leading government and companies to have inaccurate ideas of who we actually are when making those decisions. Can you give me an example how that might play out?
Well, we're seeing a lot of decisions being made about people on the basis of information in their files. Problem is that information in the files about people simply isn't correct all the time. That's not a matter of misinterpreting it. It's just that it's wrong. And when you think about it, that's not really so surprising. Large organizations make a lot of mistakes, and data entry in particular is subject to a lot of mistakes. But, you find, elderly people getting mailings from Walmarts about, congratulations on graduating high school. Here are the deals we can offer you. That's completely harmless. Not so much of a problem if you end up deported because the government's lost the information that proves you're a citizen.
Right. I know that as a reporter, I delve into a lot of things that in my personal life I wouldn't be interested in at all, perhaps. And then suddenly I get ads related to that popping up in Facebook, and I think, wow, they're really keeping track. I mean, you wrote that Facebook can follow a user's web browsing even if they're not logged into Facebook at the time. How does that happen, and how does that benefit Facebook?
One of Facebook's key assets is the information it has about its users, in part because it can monetize that information by allowing advertisers to target ads to Facebook users. If I'm selling speedboats, I don't necessarily want to spray my ads out across the world at large. I want to get my ads to people who are actually likely to buy speedboats, and Facebook can help me do that. So in a lot of ways, the most important commodity across the World Wide Web are the eyeballs and attentions of readers, of viewers. But basically, the notion is if you're not paying, you're the product. And the viewers here, they're the product. They're what's being sold in the web economy.
So an ad at the side for Facebook, that seems innocuous enough. But you note that Facebook combines its data with information from data brokers, such as the credit agency Experian. How much do they know about us because of that trading of data, combining of data, mingling, and the larger picture of us?
They know a great deal, although, again, some people might consider this a saving grace. A lot of what they know is wrong. Facebook is delighted to sell you a list of recently married people in Oregon who are in the market for a minivan because they've got the data points that enable them to do them. Folks out there have the data points to sell a list of people on diabetes medication, or people not currently on diabetes medication who might be in the market for that soon. All of that information is out there. It's sellable. In the right markets, you can easily purchase it. All of this is legal. On the other hand, at least right now, not all of that information is accurate. So you may get your diabetes medication ads, even though, thankfully, this is not your problem.
About those mistakes, about those errors, you note in Europe, an ordinary person can go see their own digital profiles. They can access that. But in the U.S., we cannot. So what could we do with that information if we did have access to it?
In Europe, Europe has broad-ranging data privacy laws that across the board place really sharp, sweeping limitations on what so-called data proprietors, on what people who have access to information about you can do with that information, the circumstances under which they can keep that information, the access they need to give you to that information. The U.S. has no such laws. The U.S. has some very specific privacy laws relating to specific sectors. It's got a health information privacy law. It's got a law maintaining the privacy of the videos you rent from the video rental store, which made more sense back in the day when there existed such a thing as video rental stores. It does have a law giving you access to your profiles at the major credit agencies, at folks like Experian, TransUnion. And you do indeed have the right to get your file from them for free periodically. So you can check for errors, and you have a right to transmit any errors you find to them. And indeed, that's something I recommend that everyone do, because Experian may think that you're carrying all sorts of credit card debt that doesn't actually exist, that could impact, say, your ability to get loans, that could impact what you need to pay to get loans in some pretty harmful ways.
But beyond those few restrictions you just mentioned, any other mistakes that companies or the government have that paint us to be a different person than we actually are, we can't even go and find out about it and correct it.
Absolutely right.
You say it's already possible that companies might charge higher prices to some people rather than others based on any number of attributes in the way that auto insurance already does. Tell us how that might work with other products we want to buy.
Well, one place that we're definitely seeing that right now is Amazon. I may not see the same price that you see when we're logged into Amazon and looking at the same products, because Amazon knows enough about us that, you know, its algorithm generates one price for you and another price for me.
Sure. Well, lawyers make a lot more money than public radio reporters, so that's good enough, right?
Well,
I win. But that's an amazing thing when you think about it, because we all think we're getting a fair shake on this, and you're saying that may not be the case.
But more generally, I mean, stuff that may not be so endearing as lawyers getting charged higher prices. One of the things we're seeing is folks charging higher prices, paradoxically, to people who live in poor neighborhoods, because people who live in poor neighborhoods may have fewer bricks and mortar options for that particular product and are stuck with buying online in a way that people in richer neighborhoods don't. And at that point, people who have less money actually end up paying more online by virtue of the fact that the sellers know more about them and know that they have fewer options.
It's like economic redlining.
No, that's absolutely right. And I think more generally, one of the things we're seeing is that the more vendors and service providers know about us, the more they have the opportunity to treat us differently based on factors that used to be lumped in the category of none of your business. That a vendor may think, you know, I'm a worse credit risk because I've had marriage counseling. I haven't had marriage counseling. It's a hypothetical. Mom, dad, don't worry. A vendor may think I'm a worse credit risk because I've had marriage counseling and end up being more reluctant to give me a loan or to charge me a higher price. And that's simply, I think, not good for us as a society.
I think most people would just see that as wrong in general, not fair, something that should be monitored. So in your conclusion, you talked about we need to talk about government enacting some rules constraining or containing some of this activity. How's that going to happen?
Well, there are two questions bundled up in that. One is, what would it look like? And the second is, could this really happen in the United States? And I think the obstacles to broad-ranging privacy legislation in the U.S. are really powerful, because we've allowed a potent, lucrative sector of the economy to grow up around selling people's information.
Sure, Google and Facebook are going to lobby pretty hard against
right.
any restrictions.
And those folks aren't going to give in without a fight on restrictions on what they can do. That said, even though there are flaws and problems associated with European-style privacy legislation, what really drives the information economy in the U.S. and what drives the potential for the sort of discrimination I've described is the fact that we don't have across-the-board privacy rules the way Europe does. And maybe the answer isn't that. Maybe the answer is that we need to think smaller, because we're not going to get European privacy-style rules, and there are reasons why we might not want them, even if we could get them. But perhaps we should think more about sectoral legislation. Maybe we want to think more about what credit cards and banks can take into account in deciding whether they grant you a loan. The Federal Trade Commission has an inquiry going right now on what should be in bounds, what should be out of bounds for lending decisions. And that's really, I think, something that it's important not to ignore.
Jonathan Weinberg is a law professor at Wayne State University and has published numerous articles on internet and high technology law and policy, including the article we've been discussing, which is titled The Real Costs of Cheap Surveillance. You can find it at theconversation.com. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We're headed to Ypsilanti for our next Artisans of Michigan. Cree Fuller is already at work in the garage behind his house when I arrived. I've seen some of his work in photos online, but I was not quite ready for the display set up in his garage. It's great eye candy. What does he make? Well, I'll let him describe them.
Well, I make robot-inspired sculptures. You know, I try to make them look like a vintage robot from the future. Yeah,
I like that, vintage from the future.
Yeah. Yes, vintage from the future. I do want them to have a vintage aesthetic, but also, you know, them being, you know, it's that version of what people in the 50s thought the future would be like. You know, robots and tin men helping us out around the house. It hasn't really panned out. There's no, we don't have any flying cars yet. You know, some of them look a little menacing. As I go, my trajectory is a little bit spooky, and that's kind of how I get my artistic fun out of it.
We've got a bunch of photos of the sculptures and lamps on our website, michiganradio.org. Fuller says he started making the robot sculptures simply to put some art on his walls at home. People liked them, wished they had one.
I thought they were gag gifts, you know, I didn't think much of it. So I just started making them. You know, they evolved and light bulbs were implemented and they became lamps and they became more popular, and I just figured I probably should spend a little bit more time and energy on them, you know, taking it a little bit more seriously that rather than something passive.
Fuller says he's self-taught and always made sort of arty things.
I'm a tinker, you know, taking things apart, putting them back together in a different way. That's all it pretty much amounts to.
Tell me about where you get the material.
I mean, just various, you know, Recycle Ann Arbor is a huge source of various scrap, people just dropping off boxes of random things out of Grandpa's garage. Those are my favorite. Rusty old boxes of treasure. You know, antique stores, resale shops, side of the road. Now that people know I do this stuff, people are apt to drop off their scrap on me and I can fish through it and see what's good. As I put it, I just kind of throw it on the pile and wait for inspiration to strike.
You know, I've been taking photos of your shelves back there. Lots of coffee pots, lots of thermoses, and a whole bunch of kitchen utensils.
Yeah. Yes, a lot of mid-century kitchen utensils. I think that old aluminum just has the patina I want. I can polish it, and I can make it look chromey, or I can leave it rough, and it has that matted look, and it looks dated. It works easier than kind of the later part of the last century, you know, when they started doing more stainless steel and harder metals and stuff, they lost some soul. You know, the old coffee pots from the 40s and 50s, they just look cool to begin with. So they help me do my job a little better.
He says when he started making those robot head sculptures as lamps, people really loved them and bought them. He says he started getting more serious about making them at that point. So one day he was getting ready for an exhibition, and he needed a name for his endeavor.
Tin Angry Men. It's a friend of mine, Dan.
And that's T-I-N.
Yeah, Tin Angry Men. You know, he, when I was getting going and about ready to do my first little art show, he just kind of said, what are you going to call your Tin Angry Men? And I was like, well, why not that? And I just kind of went with it. Again, at that point, not really taking it too seriously. I didn't quite understand the scope or how much people love robots and things that look like robots, or, you know, I think it really speaks to a lot of people, and it certainly speaks to me.
Fuller says he can make a smaller piece in about a day. Larger ones take longer, especially if there's painting involved or if he just can't find that one gadget that would complete a piece. There are a lot of boxes of spare parts in the garage, and sometimes that takes a little while. The key is making something that makes him happy in the end.
You know, I'm still doing what I want. I don't take a whole lot of commissions. It's just like, this is what I want to do. This is what I want to make. So, and people have been good about accepting what comes out of my brain, I guess, and from my hands.
By the way, the barking comment, that was from Cree Fuller's work buddy and watchdog, Chickens. That's Cree Fuller with 10 Angry Men Industries in Ypsilanti, our latest artisan of Michigan. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Kathy Gray at the Free Press reported yesterday that the Michigan Senate passed legislation that would vastly increase corporate and special interest spending on campaigns. Joining me to talk about that are Vicki Barnett, the former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator, and Joe Hoffman, a former Republican state representative from Holland. He served as the chair of the House Appropriations Committee. So, Vicki, if money is free speech, as the Supreme Court ruled in 2010, then it appears we could soon have unlimited free speech. What do you think of this legislation?
I'm not a fan of the Senate bills that passed out yesterday and are on their way to a speedy passage in the State House. There's problems with it. There's also problems with not doing anything. We had an opportunity in the state of Michigan to really clarify what super PACs should be and to make sure that we had massive transparency in terms of accounting and spending on these things. There are over 70 super PACs, as reported by MERS in the news last night. There's already 70 super PACs operating in Michigan. What is most problematic about the bills that were passed is they also allow not just the free speech and the segregation of the PAC with no communication with the candidate, but it now allows candidates to solicit unlimited funds to these super PACs, the ones that are friendly to them. And it allows sharing of consultants between candidate committees and their super PACs and attorneys between the candidate committees and the super PACs, which really leave the question open is how independent are these super PACs if that kind of consultant sharing can go on and that the candidate can actually solicit funds into these PACs.
Joe, the Democrats are saying the last thing voters want is more corporate money influencing elections. What's your take?
You know, I haven't followed these bills closely. The one thing that when I was in Lansing and now, I think people are just fed up with all the tweaking of the elections. I mean, elected officials are sent there to do public policy for the greater good. They're not there to always keep changing the rules of how you get elected. That being said, you know, this codifies what the Supreme Court has already put in place. And I think it is what it is. They have ruled that it's a form of free speech and it shouldn't be infringed on.
Well, here's a question for both of you. How does more dark money, that is anonymous donors giving to super PACs to influence elections, how does that serve the interest of democracy? Vicki?
It really doesn't, and that's part of the problem. There has been such a push for so much money into campaigns. In fact, early this week, Representative Dave Trott decided not to run for Congress again, citing wanting to spend more time with his family. But in conversations in the press, he also cited the fact that he just doesn't want to have to keep raising the huge sums of money that are necessary now to get elected. And he was talking about up to $5 million for a congressional race. And we are spending more and more money on elections and getting fewer and fewer results for people and the citizens that they serve. So I'm really concerned about the amount of money that's going into elections, and this just opens the door much wider. I think Joe is right. The public is tired of the amount of money that it costs to run for election. It really creates huge barriers of entry for normal people who want to get involved in the political process, get elected, and serve their community. It's really a shame.
Joe, same question. How does dark money serve the interest of democracy?
Well, I don't disagree with very much of what Vicki said. I think there is way too much money, and I have friends that are in Congress too, and I hear the stories about the dialing for dollars that they have to do so much of their time in order to keep the coffers up and be ready for that next election. And it is a shame we send them there to work on public policy, same way we send state representatives and senators to Lansing to work on public policy. And the fact that these bills next week are going to the elections committee, you know, we have a whole committee set up to just keep tweaking and changing and refining our election laws. And we shouldn't be continually changing the rules of the game. In this case, we're codifying what the Supreme Court said for both unions and corporations, that funding is free speech. And I don't know another way of doing this. Perhaps at a national level, at a federal level, that's where the law should change first.
I just also want to point out that the term limit law that was passed in Michigan was designed by those that supported it to create a citizen legislature where the average person could run for office, serve for a few years, and then go back into private industry or whatever their career was prior. This really sets up barriers to that whole notion that an average citizen can get it together to run for office when it takes hundreds of thousands of dollars even to win a state senate or a state house seat.
Well, there is research out of Wayne State University that indicated that the term limits have had exactly the opposite effect. In fact, now these super PACs and the corporate interests behind them, or the special interests behind them, are choosing their own candidates and recruiting them. So I'm not sure how that's helpful to citizen legislature. So, Joe, if the politicians are tired of dialing for dollars, you know, most citizens, I think, find this a little distasteful that money has so much influence on our elections. Why isn't it being cracked down on instead of expanded?
I don't have an answer to that. I never served on the elections committee. I stayed as far away from that side of the game as I could. I went there to do public policy. But I'm frustrated as well, and I agree with Vicky on term limits as well. I voted for term limits, believing that it would set up a system where people weren't afraid to make tough decisions. In reality, it didn't work that way. And I'm a part of that issue as well. I'm just throwing my hat in the ring for the state senate. So yeah, maybe that's just part of the bigger problem, is how do you get people to Lansing, do their work, serve enough time that they have the experience and not have a revolving door of freshmen coming in, but also get citizen legislators in that know what they're talking about and doing the public's good.
Vicky, last word.
We had an opportunity to really open up the doors to transparency in the state of Michigan and to really clarify what Michigan wanted to see in the election process. And unfortunately, we totally missed the opportunity to be more transparent, to shut the door on dark money, and to make sure that our election process worked for the citizens of the state of Michigan and not for special interest groups and corporations. It's sad.
And Joe, your final words.
You know, Vicky and I are pretty close on this. I unfortunately think the Senate's probably doing the right thing in codifying what the courts have said, but I don't think anybody loves it.
This is the first time I've heard you two in complete agreement.
I think it's the first time since we've known each other.
Yeah, we agree on some things, but this is the first time we're totally there. Yeah.
Thanks to both of you. Hope you have a great weekend.
All right. Thank you.
You too. Thank you.
That's Joe Haveman, a former Republican legislator, and Vicky Barnett, a former Democratic legislator. They both served in the House. This week, Attorney General Bill Schuette announced he was running for governor, to absolutely nobody's surprise. He's one of six Republicans to announce, and we're expecting more. Among the Democrats, four candidates have announced, including my guest today, Abdul El-Sayed. You've been on what you call a listening tour lately. So what have you learned from the heard from the voters?
We're learning a lot, and I'm traveling all over the state. We've been to 80 different cities and 40 different counties already. And I'll tell you, it doesn't matter where you go, whether you're in southwest Detroit or southwest Michigan, people are talking about the same sets of challenges. They're worried about being locked out of an economy that they don't feel includes them anymore. They worry about the quality of education that their kids are getting in schools that are getting substantially less funding than they have and less than other regional states. They worry about the status of our water, whether that means the poisoning of the Great Lakes by a line in the Straits of Mackinac, or the fact that the water in Flint continues to be leaded, or the fact that in a lot of homes in Detroit, unfortunately, there's no water in homes at all. And they worry about the status of healthcare, people worrying about the fact that if they get a diagnosis of a disease that's going to be very costly to treat, that they're going to have to put their family in dire financial straits to be able to get the treatment that they need. And it's remarkable to me that in this moment of polarization that we're not able to just focus on solutions to those problems. And that's exactly what this campaign is about. And it means a lot to me that people are sharing their stories with me all over the state. And I'm very thankful to be able to learn and propose policies that deal with the problems that keep people up at night and that they talk about with their families at their dinner table.
Let's touch on the first point you made, and that is they feel like the economy has left them behind. You know, we just saw a report, I think it was this week, that indicated that the middle class has actually seen an increase like it's never seen before, at least not in recent history. So is that more perception or reality?
Well, I think it's both, right? But the challenge right now is that we're seeing huge growths in inequality. And so what the middle class is not the same thing as it used to be. And so I don't think we're really comparing apples to apples. But if you look at labor participation, there's a good 10% of people who were, in effect, frozen out of the economy back in 2008 when we were facing one of the greatest recessions in living history. And haven't been able to find a way back in. And so I think that inequality is part of what we're perceiving in this moment. But part of it is also, if you just look at real wages, they have fallen over the past several years. And so I think right now we're starting to see unemployment rates that are kind of buttressed by the fact that the way that we account for who does and doesn't have a job and how much they make doesn't really compare apples to apples anymore.
I'm curious, when politicians go on these town hall tours or listening tours, how much of that is about getting your message out versus actually learning about voters' concerns?
Well, I'll tell you, we start every single town hall that we do by passing out a series of quarter sheets that ask people a very simple question. What are the issues that keep you up at night? And then we look at those and actually bring them back to the office, and we have a pretty sophisticated way of turning them into data that helps us to really understand the challenges that people face. And then in the process, most of the time that we spend is talking about challenges, learning about what ails people, the things that frustrate them in their daily lives, and then talking a little bit about proposed solutions, whether there are proposed solutions or, more importantly, learning about solutions that people are really interested in. And so for us, we really do try and dignify the listening in the listening tour.
You've never been elected to any public office. Governing a state the size of Michigan requires knowledge of a huge range of operations, from building and fixing roads, running prisons, protecting health. It's basically a $56 billion corporation, and its product is serving 10 million people. Without political experience, why do you think you're qualified to govern Michigan?
Well, I think the point that you made about being able to serve people is critical. And for me, my work has always been about service. I trained as a physician, and I served the city of Detroit as health commissioner. I'm the only Democrat in this race who has any experience leading a complex institution in government. As a health director, I rebuilt Detroit's health department after it was privatized when the city was facing emergency management.
Yeah, it was a pretty small office, though, right?
Well, it was when I started, and by the time I walked out, it was an office that was responsible for providing health services for 700,000 people, and doing so in ways that were more innovative than any other health department in Michigan and among the most innovative in the country. And what we realized is that the responsibility to be able to provide a basic set of services is really about what dignifies government generally. And so we built programs to do things like provide glasses to children, guaranteed free of charge at school, to stand up to some of the biggest corporate polluters in our state, to make sure that children were not drinking leaded water in their schools after the Flint water crisis. Those are initiatives that we built out. And I'm the only person in this race on the left who knows the experience of having to answer to the challenges that people face, whether it's 1 p.m. in the afternoon or 1 a.m. in the middle of the night. And the responsibility to work with both the federal government, state government, and then also stakeholders in communities across the city, that's an experience that I think will lend well to governing this state. Now, nobody who's never been governor before is going to have the kind of experience to know exactly what's going to happen on the first day of work. But I'll tell you, the experience that I bring to the table of an experience of service, of knowing what it means to serve in very complex ways in challenging environments, to be able to work with stakeholders across the table, to be able to accomplish a set of ends, those are unique experiences that I think bode well for being able to run this $56 billion agency whose responsibility it is to dignify the lives of real people across this community. And I'll tell you, the reason that we're so focused on listening in communities is because
because we need to understand what's not working in government right now and how is it that we are able to propose solutions that really dignify the values that we hold of equity and sustainability and justice. And I think there's a lot more that we can do, and I'm confident that we are learning what we need to learn to be able to lead toward an effective Michigan that is a place where anybody and everybody has a shot at the best life.
I hate political racehorse questions, but I have to look at the polling that's been done so far. Not a lot of it, but it's not revealed a lot of support for your campaign. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, look, I think it's really, really early days. If I had to ask you right now who's going to win the Super Bowl, I don't think you could give me a good answer. The season's just getting started. And I'll tell you this, the polls that have been conducted have been flawed in some real ways. If you look at the kind of support that we're getting, and we're getting from all over the state, it's young people, it's people of color in a number of communities, it's the progressive movement, and a lot of the polls that have been done just because of the law aren't actually able to call cell phones. So you got to ask yourself, who are you actually polling if you're calling landlines in the middle of the day, right? And I don't allow them to carry much weight. And just as a matter of example, in a poll of primary voters in the 2016 primary, Bernie Sanders was losing by 40 points 7 months before the race, and we know what happened there. So our job is to keep getting our messaging out, to be able to learn and listen to people in communities all over the state, to propose solutions that are structurally viable and accomplishable, and to be able to do the work of inspiring people to believe in their government again.
Dr. Abdul El-Sayed is running for Michigan governor as a Democrat. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
One of the things I love about science is that scientists check each other's work. I mean, there's this big back and forth testing of evidence that's generally welcome, even if your original finding turns out to be wrong. And here's an example. Several years ago, there was a study by Carney, Cuddy, and Yap on power poses. It suggested that a power pose, something like standing with feet apart, hands on your hip, think Wonder Woman or Superman stances, that those power poses might have some positive hormonal and psychological benefits. Power poses might make you more successful. Here's one of the researchers, Amy Cuddy, during a 2012 TED Talk.
So I want to ask you first, you know, both to try power posing, and also I want to ask you to share the science, because this is simple. I don't have ego involved in this. Give it away. Like, share it with people, because the people who can use it the most are the ones with no resources and no technology and no status and no power. Give it to them, because they can do it in private. They need their bodies, privacy, and 2 minutes, and it can significantly change the outcomes of their life. Thank you.
That TED Talk is the second most viewed TED Talk ever, more than 40 million views. But studies to replicate the findings have not succeeded. A wave of scientific studies spearheaded by a Michigan State University researcher, Joseph Cesario, suggest no, power poses do not improve your life, do not make you more successful. But hey, you still look good. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Rusty Brock. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Jacob Meschke, and Daniel Hensel. And contributed commentary by Chickens. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.